For the week of July 18th, 2013, this is the Energy Gang podcast from Green Tech Media. I'm Stephen Lacey, a senior editor at Green Tech Media in Washington, D.C. As usual, I'm joined by my discerning co-hosts. In Colorado this week is Jigar Shah of Jigar Shah Consulting and author of the upcoming book, Creating Climate Wealth. Jigar, how are you? What are you doing in Colorado this week?
I am speaking at the Biennial of the Americas, but more importantly, I'm staying cool and dry.
And sweltering here in D.C. with me is Catherine Hamilton. Hey, Catherine, how are you?
Just great. I'm just glad this is not TV, that it's radio.
Wow, you got a little sweat on your brow?
Yeah, yeah, just a little bit. We're all wearing the least we can get away with right now.
You've been in D.C. for a long time, though. You must have a high heat tolerance.
It's gotten worse. I believe the climate change stuff.
Mine's gotten better since I've been here. Hey, did you see this news about the Maryland water shortages?
Yeah, there's a big water main that broke, right?
Yeah, so getting into this heat wave, this week-long heat wave, there are, you know, 200,000 people in Prince George's County, Maryland, looking like they might not have water for the week, which is actually really interesting because it brings us into one of our first topics. You know, it's a really serious problem related to crumbling water infrastructure. It looks like they're actually going to divert some of this water and keep the taps on for thousands of people, but you know, water utilities are withdrawing tens of billions of gallons of water a day, and somewhere around 6 billion of that is lost to leaks and inefficiencies. So there's a real clean tech opportunity there, and that's something that we're going to get into, not as it relates to water utilities necessarily, but as it relates to electric utilities. So while we're actually stuck in this heat dome with our air conditioners and fans cranking and communities like that in Maryland deal with water issues, it seemed appropriate to start this week's podcast off with a look at the water energy nexus. The Union of Concerned Scientists is out with a new report outlining a pathway for reducing power plant water withdrawals 97%, and we'll ask, is that feasible? Then we'll turn to summer gas prices. The days of cheap gas are over, we know that, but why? It's not an easy answer. We'll look at the many factors involved, and more importantly, the implications for clean tech. And finally, is a solar panel in New Jersey really 15 times more valuable than a solar panel in Arizona? A new study concludes it is. We'll tell you the reason. And of course, we'll tell you something you don't know to round out the show. Okay, on to our first topic. Power plants represent 40% of freshwater withdrawals in this country, potentially making them vulnerable to shutting down and ramping down significantly during heat waves when the water resources aren't available for cooling. We use a lot of power to move water around the country as well. So last summer was a stark reminder of that when we were in this really severe and prolonged drought, and that forced a number of power plants around the country to ramp down. So we know the problem. What is the solution? The Union of Concerned Scientists Energy and Water Initiative released its own pathway this week, showing that efficiency in water-sipping renewables could reduce freshwater withdrawals in the power sector by 97% by mid-century and cut water consumption by 85%, and that includes evaporation. Anyone want to take a first whack at this report? I thought it was really interesting, very relevant considering this week's heat wave gripping the center and the East Coast. Anything jump out to anyone of significance?
Well, I thought it was a great report, but you know, I think that it's a number of reports that have come out. I mean, so Scripps, for instance, which is the well-regarded institution out of San Diego, you know, has now put out sort of an announcement saying that they believe that by the end of 2025, that Lake Mead will be dry, right, which is where all the water comes from to provide drinking water to Las Vegas. Right. And so the only real way to keep Lake Mead going is to shut down the coal plants along the Colorado River that are taking water for cooling. So I just think that this isn't really just an esoteric macro conversation. There are real cities in jeopardy that are going to have to spend billions of dollars to figure out how to compete with these power plants to meet their freshwater needs.
What was clear in this report is that there are plenty of examples where this conflict is underway today, and so this is not theory that we're talking about. You know, you mentioned the Hoover Dam. In 2012, UCS points out that low water levels at Lake Mead caused a 23% drop in Hoover Dam generation. So this is happening. It's happening to nuclear power plants and other thermal power plants around the country, and they outline a number of examples of that. So I think what is clear from this report is that this is not theory, that this conflict is happening today.
Yeah, what they've stressed in this that that NREL also did a report about a couple of years ago was that low carbon technologies are not necessarily low water. And so that's not just, I mean, nuclear power uses a huge amount of water, but water cooled renewables that you, you know, concentrating solar, the type that uses a cooling tower, would use a lot of water. Biomass, if you're using crops, that uses a lot of water. So you don't just have to look at what's clean, but also really dig down a little bit further into what the water use is of any given technology.
Which also dictates the choices we have to make about fossil energies as well. Some people believe that carbon capture and storage should play a big role, considering that coal is still going to be a pretty major force for the coming decades. And many people see nuclear as a low carbon panacea. But as we see, both technologies, you know, assuming we have a lot of coal, that will still demand a lot of water, and nuclear demands a lot of water as well. And under a scenario with high CCS penetration and high nuclear penetration, we could see the need for water to grow 14% over business as usual. So these two technologies, CCS and nuclear, which on the face of it look like they could be potentially promising, change when you factor in the water equation.
Yeah, and yeah. I actually think that water, the water issue is going to be the bigger driver.
Well, absolutely. I mean, so World Resources Institute did a report 2 years ago that shows that 79% of all the new coal plants that have been proposed in India are in severe water-stressed locations. And so, and just a few months ago, India announced that they were going to cancel a lot of those coal plants because they simply can't get the cooling water necessary to run the plants. And so I think you're actually in this vortex right now where you have a whole bunch of announcements from the Breakthrough Institute about how we can't do anything without nuclear, and you have a whole bunch of announcements from other folks saying we can't do anything about CCS, but this sort of systemic look at what it is that we're doing to be able to power the 21st century is what's necessary. And unless you include water into that systemic look, you're looking at only part of the equation.
I'm still not seeing that play a major role in the policy conversation. Are either of you seeing any significant changes in factoring in water to energy decisions?
Oh, I see people like Johnny Isaacson from Georgia is very interested in water efficiency and ties it very closely to energy efficiency. But yeah, there's definitely some interest.
Wasn't there a petition that got put up to the White House this week? I don't remember which one that was.
Yeah, so the American Clean Energy Agenda, it's the Environmental Working Group and Civil Society Institute. There are about 120 citizen organizations. They just released a proposed executive water to identify all these critical water resources, and then how would we plan our, how we rejigger our electric grid so that we there less thermoelectric water use. Very interesting proposal for an executive order, which I think might get some attention.
I was actually expecting to see something like that in the president's climate plan. I don't want to go too far down that path because we've talked about that a lot, but I'm surprised that more water issues didn't come up in the president's climate plan. So it's nice to see that organizations are pushing the administration on this. But still, I'm just not seeing regulatory agencies on the local level take water factors into account as much as they could be. So that's pretty concerning to me.
Well, I think the flip side of this is the opportunity, right? And so I think when you think about the federal government in the United States and how much control it has over the water supply in the U.S., given the control over the hydro supply, given the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, given, WAPA and the Bonneville Power Administration, there actually is a tremendous amount that the president could do with executive orders and executive power.
But if we really want to factor water into the equation, we have to think holistically about this. So UCS talks about this a little bit in the report, but they show under a business as usual scenario, we ramp up natural gas significantly, nuclear phases out after a couple decades, and coal starts to get phased out. So natural gas, potentially using less water for generation, but when you look at the water used for fracking itself, you know, there are, the EPA estimates that between 70 and 140 billion gallons of water are used to fracture wells in the U.S. each year. And, you know, that's starting to match up with the hundreds of billions of gallons that the power sector uses to cool power plants. We're getting into some pretty dangerous territory, and that's conflicting with farmers and other agricultural operations and communities that are really starting to feel the impact of drought, as we saw in 2012. So interesting that the administration is thinking a little bit about this water issue, but really not thinking about it holistically. And if we ramp up fracking significantly, these conflicts around water are just going to continue to get worse. So I think that's an important piece of this conversation that just hasn't had much play yet.
You're exactly right. And one last tie-in from last week, though, is that China has actually announced that it's not going to pursue shale gas with gusto over the next 5 years because of the water implications.
And they just don't know how to do it, right?
Well, you know, I mean, Fareed Zakaria, and then, of course, with the State Department memo from last week, you know, I mean, part of that would be a technology sharing compact, right? So I think that, I mean, my guess is if we're serious about climate change, we actually want the folks in China to stop burning as much coal. But, you know, but natural gas is not a great alternative for them given its water consumption issues.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that China example. I know that there are a lot of issues with technical problems around fracking there and their inability to actually do it correctly. But as you point out, in India, in China, and elsewhere, the water conflicts are serious and real. These are going to get worse. And this is not theory we're talking about. So I think this report is very relevant.
So the other thing to think about here is a water tax. I mean, so the coal industry and others who get primary level water directly from bidding on water contracts and that kind of thing, you know, pay 99% less than I pay for a gallon of water at my my house. Now, it makes sense that they pay less just because they're consuming so much more, but you can imagine that if they, you know, increase the cost substantially of water, that coal might actually go up in cost tremendously as well.
All right, well, on to our second topic. This week, an executive from AAA told the Senate that gas prices below $3 are a thing of the past and we should get used to them. This isn't surprising to people who follow the energy markets, but certainly something that American consumers are still getting used to, and American politicians as well. Indeed, gas prices started off at $3.29 per gallon in January, which was the highest ever for the beginning of the year. This comes as the U.S. is producing more oil than it has since the mid-90s. As usual, lawmakers came up with a dozen different reasons in a hearing this week on why gas prices are this high. They blamed refinery capacity, rail transport, OPEC countries, the global markets broadly, and even the renewable fuels standard. Jigar, what do you think? Do you trust any particular theory here? Complicated.
Well, just to be clear, we're talking about gasoline and not natural gas.
We are talking about gasoline, yes.
But I, you know, the thing that shocks me is that, you know, the entire Department of Energy was created after the Arab oil crises in the 1970s. We should at this point actually be good at understanding, you know, the factors that go into pricing gasoline. And what was shocking to me from the hearing was that there were 10 different theories put forward, none of which were actually adjudicated. It didn't seem like any of the senators in this particular hearing sort of had a point of view as to what the top three things that they could do were to really reduce gasoline prices. And so, you know, some people were blaming the renewable fuel standard. Other folks were blaming refinery capacity and the different regulations that we have by jurisdiction around air quality. Still others were saying that, you know, that the real problem that we have is that we're transferring a lot of gasoline and diesel to Europe and we've got some of these transportation issues. And so I just find it shocking that we don't even in the rearview mirror have an understanding of why gasoline prices are what they are.
Well, I have two thoughts on this. First, it's obviously very complicated and there is a confluence of factors. And any expert who watches oil markets and gasoline markets will tell you that it is a combination of a variety of factors. And that anyone who tells you it's one particular factor either doesn't know what they're talking about or is wrong. So that played out in this hearing this week, and it should be clear to folks that we can't blame any one particular factor for high gas prices and high oil prices. With that said, even if we can't agree on the exact cause, I think that it's pretty clear that a reduction in consumption is what can protect consumers from price shocks. And so OMB came out with a report in 2012 looking at oil and gasoline price dynamics, and found that really the only way that consumers are ever going to get shielded from any particularly disastrous price spike is to use less oil, to invest in more efficient alternatives. And although we can't necessarily agree on the cause, the solutions are pretty clear.
Yeah, and the talking point has been that the president actually has some control over it. I don't know if you watch Newsroom, but there was a scene in it where it's supposed to be the Romney bus, and he turns to a member of the press and he goes, "So what's Obama got the gas price at today?" And it's like there's some kind of talking point that somehow the president has something to say over the price of gasoline.
Yeah.
And that talking point, people know that's not right, but they actually treat it as if it's truth. And so I think that Jigar was really right about that. One thing I would say is that Heather Zeichel today was really, and she's, you know, Obama's main climate lead now, was really bullish on the RFS for cellulosic ethanol, and saying, you know, repealing it would be very short-sighted. So they were very bullish on the RFS as a long-term policy.
Yeah, just on those two points. First, the attacks on the president specifically for his supposed role in gas prices have tempered a bit after the election, but it was just ludicrous the amount of attacks we saw last year blaming the president for high gas prices. And actually, the Cato Institute and other conservative organizations, including the Wall Street Journal, came out and said, "Come on, guys, this is silly. The president does not dictate gasoline prices or oil prices." Now, on the biofuels front, I think what this shows, so outside of the political context here, the fight around whether we should have the RFS in place or not, I think that these high gasoline and oil prices show a fundamental flaw in advanced biofuels today. A barrel of WTI crude is trading at $107 today. A gallon of gasoline is averaging about $3.68 right now. So we've heard that advanced biofuels like cellulosics and LG fuels were supposed to be competitive with that today. And we've heard that time and time again. But we've seen virtually nothing but struggles from producers here in the U.S. And this has been due to a number of factors. One was financial struggles in getting plants built after the financial crisis. But a lot of it has to do with technical failures, and very few companies have actually gotten beyond pre-commercial scale. So as a result, we saw the Renewable Fuels Association calling for the EPA to once again scale back its target for 14 million gallons of cellulosic fuels by this year. And you know, the EPA has already had to scale it back. So as much as anything, I think this points to some major difficulties in biofuels as well.
Can I just take the other side of this argument for a second?
Sure.
You know, one of the things that just frustrates me more than anything is the lack of leadership. I get the fact that the president isn't responsible for gasoline prices, but if the OMB, and this is literally the 81st report that we've gotten since 1978 when, you know, ExxonMobil returned all the shares of Saudi Aramco back to the Saudis, we've known that if we actually change the amount of oil that is used in the world by just 2 million barrels a day, we can dramatically reduce the global cost of oil. That's where oil prices trade, right? We know how to reduce 2 million barrels a day of oil. I mean, let's say we decided as the G8 that our countries combined, right? So the U.S. pays about $500 billion more for gasoline today than it did in diesel and other products than it did 10 years ago. Right. And that number is the same for everyone else. So you add all that stuff up. Let's say it's $1 trillion. What would it cost to reduce fuel consumption by 2 million barrels a day in 8 months? It's not that much.
I don't see what you're getting at here, though. What's your
So,
point?
so the president could say, we're going to launch an $80 billion cash for clunkers, program right now to basically take all the cars that are pre, 2004 off the road and replace them with new fuel efficient cars, right? The president could say, we are going to finally take all the regulations at EPA out of the equation that are preventing methanol cars, which are hugely popular in China. But for whatever reason, it seems like we have the RFS, which is great, but we don't seem to have any real momentum and leadership and passion around how we actually do what the Office of Management and Budget says in its report, which is basically reduce fuel consumption by 2.5 million barrels a day.
Yeah, but how can you not say that the most aggressive fuel standards in history that have been developed for light vehicles by the Obama administration is not leadership? And then the amount of money that the DOE has put into advanced biofuels and electric vehicles, they might not be targeting the exact programs that you want to target, but they're definitely doing something in this area. And to just say that because they're not doing the exact thing that you think they should be doing, that doesn't mean that there's a lack of leadership. There are plenty of good programs out there that have and will continue to reduce fuel consumption.
I'm not disagreeing with that, and that's why I said I'm taking the counter argument here. But what I am saying, though, is that if the President of the United States wanted to actually reduce oil prices by $30 a barrel, we actually know exactly what policies to use to do that. And it has to be not just the U.S., it has to be the G8 broadly that does it. But my sense is that there isn't consensus between the technocrats like us, the State Department, who has no idea what $60 oil would do to unrest in the Middle East as well as in Saudi Arabia and other places, who now have budgets that exceed $80 a barrel, where they need $80 a barrel just to balance their budgets. And then the U.S. Treasury Department, right, which has a completely different point of view as to, how much lower oil prices would affect the economy. So I think that's why we're not moving at scale on sort of a World War II footing to actually reduce oil prices to save poor people in this country a lot of money, because we don't have consensus between the State Department, the Treasury Department, and DOE.
But that doesn't get back to the basic premise, which is a lot of the issues we're seeing in the biofuels, the advanced biofuels space, are technical. They're not a failure of the administration. The administration has, both the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration, help provide incentives, grant programs, R&D programs for advanced biofuels. But now that they're reaching commercial scale, it's technical viability that's the problem. It's not a lack of leadership on the federal level. So I think that we're talking about two different things here in some context.
Yeah, and right. Actually, I would say it's not all technical viability, Stephen. I worked on biofuels in the 90s. I was at NREL then, and a lot of the reason it hasn't sprung forward is because of the corn ethanol industry.
But many of the folks in the corn ethanol industry are investing in this, particularly POET, which has scaled up its Liberty cellulosic biofuel plant. Many of them seem to be behind it. What am I missing here?
Yeah, so I just think that it took them a while to get there. And so in the 90s, when a lot of these pilot plants were being started, they were not given the support they needed because the corn ethanol industry wasn't supporting. Now they're shifting to it. I tend to agree with Heather Zeichel in this case that this is a long-term policy. We're going to have to wait and see how this shakes out. I think we need to give it more time.
All right, moving on to EVs. This is a very relevant discussion. Troubles in biofuels, but does this mean a boon for EVs, electric vehicles? Anyone want to go there?
Yeah, well, I wanted to let you know, I did talk to the Electric Drive Transportation Association last night. They have some great data on their electricdrive.org website, and EVs are really doing well. It's been really good, steady growth. So in 2010... there was the Volt and the Leaf, two cars. Now there are about a dozen different ones. By 2015, they say they're going to be two dozen more different kinds of vehicles. They've really been picking up. This is, considering this is new technology and new behavior for consumers, really new behavior throughout the entire value chain, this is big. This is good that it's a pretty strong rollout for new technology.
I saw that sales of the Leaf are up 319% since last May. Sales of the Volt are up 53% since June. And Tesla sales in the first quarter of this year beat Mercedes-Benz S-Class, the BMW 7 Series, and the Audi A8. So definitely a lot of growth there. The question is around battery costs, though. And this is what's holding EVs back. You know, they come in at $12,000 to $15,000. And there's really no Moore's law in batteries as there is in electronics. So you have to play around with battery chemistry, which is expensive and risky. And that's the big problem right there. So do you get the sense, Catherine, that batteries are the real issue? And what are folks saying at the electric drive transportation about that issue?
I didn't ask them specifically about batteries. I really asked them about what the market's doing right now.
Yep.
I think the battery prices are going to come down. It will. The technology is evolving. It's going to get better. There's some companies that are doing some really interesting things with batteries. We're also seeing that we're going to be moving into not just the high-priced vehicles, but it's going to be much more, you know, we're going to have a much greater variety of vehicles, diversity of prices, and that there's also a really high proliferation of charging infrastructure with a lot of different options of, you know, workplaces, commercial establishments, not just in your home, so that it's, you know, so that it's a lot more kind of socialized. So I think everything, the cost of all of that is going to start coming down as people start demanding it. I think consumers are going to demand them.
I think the problem with electric vehicles right now, as I see it, is that, you know, it's sort of destined to be sort of a 1% penetration. Right. I mean, we sold, what, 12 million cars in the United States this year. And so I think if you get to 10% penetration, that's 1.2 million cars. My sense is I'm not quite sure that we're going to, you know, hit that number anytime soon. But I think the way we could hit it is through vehicle to grid. You know, my sense is that vehicle to grid integration, the cost of the battery and the value of the battery to the utility can exceed $500-$600 a month, which is what a car payment normally is. Right. And so you really can make electric vehicles cost effective without actually dropping the price of the batteries.
But we are just not even close to that for on a regulatory level.
Well, none of the auto companies have produced cars that are vehicle to grid enabled. They believe that the new cycles, the extra cycles on the battery will prematurely make sure make the batteries fail. And so therefore they're not supporting it. And California regulation sort of, you know, is like well-intentioned, but not that great in this area because they're mandating that all the car companies provide a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty for batteries. So the car companies feel like they're between a rock and a hard place.
So, Jigar, what if you were able to build in a warranty scheme where you could take, where you could use a second life of the battery? So you can take the batteries and put them to the grid after they've been used in the cars.
It's not enough. Because the problem with the second life is it's, you know, let's say a car battery is worth, what, $12,000? And the second life would be worth $3,000 maybe? So that's $3,000. I mean, I don't think the delta between an electric vehicle and a gasoline-powered vehicle is going to get to within $3,000 anytime soon. But I think that I could actually get right now, right? Willett Kempton at the University of Delaware is getting $5 a day for his Mini Cooper BMWs that he's actually been allowed by BMW to put into the vehicle to grid because they're used cars from their pilot program in California. That's $150 a month. That's a lot of money. That's $1,500 to $1,800 a year over 7 years. That's more than $3,000.
Okay, on to our third story. How exactly do we value renewables? A new peer-reviewed study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences offers another way to consider the value of clean energy. It looked at the energy mix of 22 regions around the country and determined that renewables were worth far more in areas where they offset the dirtiest generation. So, an interesting statistic, the researchers found that the environmental and health benefits of a solar panel in New Jersey are 15 times greater than in Arizona, where sun resources are far better. And they found that a wind turbine in Ohio would be nearly 8 times more valuable than one in California. So this is the latest study looking at ways to value renewables from the climate benefits to the grid benefits. Jigar, do you dislike this study? Do you think this is an appropriate way to look at it? I know that you think that health benefits are one of the biggest ways to message renewables.
I thought this study was fascinating. I'm shocked that we hadn't actually seen it earlier, and I give huge kudos to the guys over there that did it. I just, you know, it's I really do think we need to think about our policy in a much more sophisticated way. I mean, that being said, I'm trying to figure out how I would actually take this data and put it into policy. It would be quite complicated, but the fact that we actually know this now is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. This is the kind of stuff I eat up because it's all about metrics. And it's about what metrics are you using to decide what the value of anything is? And this is getting to everything we've talked about, which is, what do we care about? So if we want to move some kind of policy, what's the end goal? What does that look like? And then what are we going to count? So looking at health, environmental, climate, I mean, this is great stuff. And if they put in, if we looked at it with other technologies, they were kind of limited in solar and wind, but looking at demand response and efficiency and storage, I mean, there would be so fascinating to be able to if we did a clean energy standard for the country or some kind of major piece of policy legislation to build in that kind of metrics. And I would say you could do other metrics too. You could use water efficiency metrics. You could use reliability and resilience metrics so that you're looking at, you know, the more of the infrastructure. So I think this really points us to, we need to look at these not just as these sort of minor externalities, but really make it part of the way we value our energy policy writ large.
Yeah, I think academic analyses like this are helpful, and they can help guide a policy conversation. But I will say that without a price on carbon, which this study looks at, these kinds of analyses are a bit useless in public policy implementation today. But here is what I like. The analysis does get us beyond carbon pricing, where we're kind of stuck these days, and shows that reducing pollutants from power plants like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide has as much weight, perhaps, as carbon emissions. And this is not abstract stuff like carbon emissions are. These are acute pollutants that impact people's lives. And so by thinking about it, renewables in this context and crafting incentives that explicitly take these into account when we talk about pollution, that probably will have a tangible impact on how we site projects. And that could influence the public policy debate more so than the carbon pricing side of things.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say, though, that, you know, so I agree with you almost completely on that. The one difference I have is that I do think, like, for instance, in Minnesota, where they just passed a solar carve out, I do think a study like this could help reinforce why they did it and give people a little more pride in why they did it, which matters, because that's how you keep the policy in place and from not getting, you know, rescinded later. And I do think that, as you mentioned, Stephen, that there may be other agencies on the healthcare side that might want to pay us a slight bonus subsidy to pay us for those health impacts.
So on an implementation level, though, here's the kicker. This is what I've been thinking about. And Jigar, you might want to jump in on this point. I know that Germany and the United States are not analogous, but let's look at Germany, where wind and solar have scaled massively. We've seen coal use increase by nearly 4%, and so have emissions. I know that that's due to a phase out in nuclear, but it shows that there's not a one-for-one trade-off here. And so that's the limitation that I see with a study like this.
So I understand what you're saying, but I don't really agree. Like, for instance, in Germany, this is really temporary. I mean, to suggest that we're going to reduce emissions in a linear fashion without bumps in the road, I think, is asking too much of policymakers. But if you look at, like, coal, for instance, just this week they announced that they retired a coal plant because it was not made to sort of be turned on and turned off. And with all the solar and wind, they actually just couldn't figure out how to maintain the coal plant. So that sort of offset the 4%.
I also think what we're missing in this conversation is the impact of demand response, of energy efficiency, of virtual power plants, microgrids, you name it. These are really powerful tools for knocking power plants off the grid. So that is as much a part of the conversation as what renewables can do to phase out coal.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mentioned that earlier, that if we could just build some more things into this study, I think it would be even more powerful.
Indeed, certainly an important study. I think it will have legs as the discussion continues around how we properly value renewables. Very early discussion. So let's wrap up the podcast and tell our listeners something they don't know. Jigar, what do you have for us this week?
So I was actually in the UK earlier this week and attended an event that was run by Solar Plaza. And I was just fascinated by the intense interest by the solar industry in selling demand response, the sort of thermostats like the Nest and other thermostats. Because what a lot of the folks in Europe were telling me was that, you know, they already get these data feeds from SMA inverters. And they're saying, well, you know, our customers already expect us to review those data feeds. So reviewing data feeds from demand response and continuous commissioning for homes is something that we naturally feel is good. So it looks like the solar industry is actually stepping up to becoming the channel partners for all these other innovative entrepreneurs.
Yeah, this is a really good point. And as the information technologies evolve, the separation between the energy efficiency industry and the solar industry is going to continue to get smaller. And these services that people can provide that bring together all these distributed technologies are going to blend together. Very interesting point. And I think you're going to see some moves from companies that cross that chasm between the traditional solar PV space and energy efficiency. Thanks for that. Catherine, what do you have?
Yeah, I just this morning attended the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee had a hearing on clean energy financing. And Ethan Zindler from Bloomberg New Energy Finance was there. Richard Kaufman, who works for Governor Cuomo in New York. Peter Davidson, who's the new head of the DOE Loan Guarantee Program. Will Coleman with OnRamp Capital. And Nicholas Loris from Heritage were all there, including, and Senator Coons was also there testifying on behalf of his bill. And, you know, one thing was that they focused on kind of new, different financial constructs like REITs and MLPs, state green banks, model contracts for bond markets, innovation tax credits. They brought up a lot of things. They also talked a lot about the DOE loan guarantee program. And while the Heritage guy was really the only one in the room who was whining about Solyndra, for the most part, it was a very interesting conversation, even though I think we need to move, you know, we need to continue to talk about it, but move beyond it. But one of the most interesting things was that, you know, when the president announced his climate plan and he said there would be $8 billion going to fossil. Well, this was clarified a little bit by Peter Davidson, who said really a lot of that is going to go to loan guarantees for clean industrial manufacturing processes, including CHP, energy storage, efficiency, and microgrids, all of which would be able to apply for that funding for those loan guarantees, which I thought was significant. I thought it was really significant. Yeah.
They're putting that into the fossil program.
Yep.
Wow.
Well, you know, when DOE in the stimulus bill put money in for CHP, the program was oversubscribed by like 10x. There's a lot of CHP plants ready to be built that just need this loan guarantee or some additional economics, or heaven forbid, get the local electric utility to drop their punitive standby charges.
Yeah, this matches up well with the 40 gigawatt target for CHP that the president outlined last year.
Yeah, and this will all be run out of the loan guarantee program. So a CHP looks like a pretty good investment.
Well, look at that. We've gotten beyond Solyndra when we talk about the loan guarantee program. Hallelujah. All right, on to mine. And so this is a little bit of a shameless plug. Next week, on Monday, July 29th, we're going to be in San Francisco holding a one-day conference on intelligent efficiency. It's called Avant EE. It's going to be at the PG&E Auditorium in downtown San Francisco. We've got a killer lineup of panelists, folks working on the front lines of intelligent efficiency, demand response, intelligent energy management, both on the software and hardware side. A lot of folks from the utility community, a ton of vendors there. So I'm really enthusiastic about it. It's something that I've been working on for some time as I've tried to ramp up our coverage around energy efficiency and really mold this intelligent efficiency concept. So if folks want more information on that, they can just go to our Green Tech Media events page and you could just search for Avant EE, and I'm happy to connect with folks on that. So shameless plug, but I am excited about it. So with that, I'm going to wrap up the show. You can find the links to stories that we talked about at greentechmedia.com. If you don't already, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Our RSS feed is linked on the podcast page, greentechmedia.com. And you can find us on SoundCloud, where we are hosted. Finally, if you have story ideas, please send them over to me. My email address is Lacey, L-A-C-E-Y, at greentechmedia.com. We would love to hear from you. And, of course, always comment on the comment section of the podcast page. We love the interaction. Catherine Hamilton, good to talk to you this week. Thanks as always.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And Jigar Shah, same to you. We'll talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure.
Indeed. With Jigar Shah and Catherine Hamilton, I'm Stephen Lacey. We are The Energy Gang, a production of greentechmedia.com. We'll catch you next week.